I hope you're getting the idea that fundamentalism is a cognitive problem of the species. We, after all, it wasn't too long ago we were living in tribes on the savannas and, you know, fighting for our lives and so on and so forth. Our autonomic roots are dark and deep. We can be territorial, authoritarian, hierarchical, jealous, rigid, or violent. And there are structures in the understories of the brain that are responsible for just those emotions. It's only that we have the lucky cerebral cortex and the white matter tracts that connect the cerebral cortex to the amygdala and the hippocampus and the lateral nuclei and the hypothalamus and all that kind of stuff. It's the only reason that we have civilization. And the only reason that we can act in a relatively civilized fashion. But we all become capable of fundamentalist thinking when we are frightened or injured, you and me. Frustrated or deprived, in the grip of a strong emotion, in a hurry and looking for a quick fix, self-justifying or narcissistic. In an altered state of consciousness, in religious rituals or places, religions have a very powerful way of doing this, and in the presence of death or tragedy, which make us really, you know, think ultimate kinds of thoughts. People have said, what structures in the brain are responsible for fundamentalism? We don't know exactly. We think it's probably an unholy synergy between certain ones. But just to make simple about it, we have certain neurons called monkey see, monkey do neurons, the mirror neurons, where we imitate others. We also have an innate primate urge to look upward in the hierarchy towards the dominant males in the group. Like many animals do, so our attention is upward in the hierarchical structure, and so we look to the policeman, the judge, the politician, the governor, whoever it is. Oh my God, I'm going to imitate him. So we have the monkey see, monkey do neurons. We have the hierarchical primate vestiges in our DNA somewhere. And we also have the limbic system, which is dark and deep and responsible for very, very strong emotions. And that's what happens when you get a head injury. The cortex, the upper part of the brain, can't control those deep primordial emotions very well. So, the 5-minute fundamentalists catechism. Learn to observe yourself by practicing mindfulness techniques. Were there some people walking mindfully and slowly around campus today?
Yes.
Did I see them?
It was lovely.
Yeah, I went, I know what group they're from. they're walking around mindfully. Now, this may seem like an outrageous suggestion, but empathize with fundamentalist thinking whenever you find it in yourself or others. Say, oh my God, I'm thinking like that. I do it all the time. Recognize that there are many kinds of fundamentalism. When you see a genuine fundamentalist strutting his or her stuff on the public stage, try instructive wonder. Ugh. There, but for the grace of God, go I. A head injury or two, a powerful emotional state, too much LSD, whatever. There I go. And by the way, of course, paranoid schizophrenic, I'm treating one right now who hears voices. And almost always these voices with the paranoid schizophrenic have a religious flavor to them, and they are not very nice. Why don't you go jump off that bridge over there, you worthless slob? You are worth garbage. You are a human walking turd. The voices say things like this. And this guy is coming to me now, and he said, can you cure anybody with voices? And I know that medicines don't work very well for this, by the way. Antipsychotic medications don't work. I have cured one guy with neurofeedback. It took a couple of years. And he took a bad acid trip. And from that time on, every day that he was at college, he would hear a voice say, hey, listen, see that broad over there? Nice boobs, right? Take her off in a bush and rape her. The voices say things like this. Now, I have a friend and colleague. This gets a little woo-woo, I know. Friend and colleague, Wilson Van Dusen. wonderful psychologist, a Swedenborgian writer, who says this is where we get our demonic lore from. The voices usually are not nice. And they usually have a religious flavor to them, and they have a fanatical flavor. You know, you are the next Messiah. That's what we're trying to tell you. You're him. And you can heal people, you can bless them, and you can make whatever you want to happen. In fact, why don't you walk out that window over there? He calls these, by the way, the lower order voices. They are equivalent to demons. And the higher order voices never interfere with human beings. They might be angels or devas, or Socrates called it a daimon. We don't know. Last one, use indwelling the other and respectful attention in controversies. Learn to understand values and experiences, even if it seems other. And friends, I have my work cut out for me. Every day, I'm trying with all the psychological tools at my wits to understand republicanism. And every now and then I get a glimpse of it, but it doesn't stick somehow. Now, during that same period of the 1840s, when all the apocalyptic religions were being formed, there were also thoughtful people who believed that nature was a tangible revelation of spiritual mystery. What an outrageous idea. God is not a... My Taoist master who taught me Qigong said, Western religion, very simple, very primitive. Think God is a guy. Not understand that God in everything. God, the power in you, God, the power in me, God, the power between us, God in nature, you can see it there. But many of the people in the 1840s were inspired by the Swedish visionary Emanuel Swedenborg, and my father became a Swedenborgian minister after a crisis in his life. And Swedenborg has grown on me over the years. My father was such a fanatic about Swedenborg that I used to groan whenever he'd start talking about him. But then I really started studying the guy, and some of you may have seen Robin's magnificent book. It took 5 years, Emanuel Swedenborg, A Continuing Vision, 500 pages, 450 illustrations. We were visiting scholars at the Swedish Institute. We photographed places throughout Europe, all over Sweden. I mean, Swedenborg was a big deal, and he never wanted to start a religion. He wanted to... He started what he called the New Church, which was in everybody's mind and heart. It wasn't supposed to be a church. He says, in fact, many people who are hypocritical go to church. What an outrageous idea. Imagine that. People who go to church could be hypocritical. He says, but there are people who are... And he thought that the most spiritual people on earth were the black Africans.
He was fascinated...
Go ahead.
He was fascinated by Native Americans and asked his some nephews who were coming over to please send him any information they could about Native Americans, because he felt that this is what he called the most ancient church. I think it's one of his most fascinating... ideas that the Sami, in Sweden, and in the north in Finland, what we used to call the Lapps, Africans, the Aboriginal people in many parts of the world, and the Native American people in the North and South America, were all people who were in touch with the most ancient church. The church in which nature is filled with divine spirit.
He developed a principle he called the principle of correspondences. Everything in nature is a tangible revelation of the divine and ought to be treated as such. He inspired the Hudson Valley School of Painting. He inspired the emancipation movement, freeing the slaves. Mm-hmm. He said slavery was an abomination, and his followers were really among the best, you know, American liberationists. He said that women were the equivalent of men. Imagine that. He said that women were the intellectual and spiritual equivalent of men. Oh, my God. He got in big trouble for that.
Yeah.
And he said that it is possible that the person that you marry on the earth may not be your soulmate. You may find another person in the spirit world who's your true soulmate. And the Swedish clerics of his time, the Lutheran clerics, said, ha ha, that is Emanuel Swedenborg's Mohammed in heaven. But he inspired some really serious people. Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry James Sr. was a great Swedenborgian philosopher. So he influenced. As an
engineer and a scientist, I was fascinated by his inventions, many of which he was a geologist, and he was a member of the Board of Mines in Sweden for many years. And many of his inventions were made to try to save the lives, what an outrageous idea, of miners. And he, during his tenure as chairman of the Board of Mines, there was a decrease in violent deaths among the miners, and many more of them were brought up out of the mines when there were accidents, and because he had all these kinds of pulleys and ropes and things that could test the air, and he was an amazing man.
He went down in there. And the wealthiest people in Sweden were the mining families. And, you know, when a mine would collapse, they didn't really take good safety precautions. They would just say, just leave them down in there, just workers anyway. Swedenborg said, they're human beings, and we've got to have provision for them to have satisfactory air and cleaner and better working conditions and safety precautions and all kinds of stuff. He's great.
And after he died, all of his precautions were simply put aside for a few more centuries, really.
Okay, so I'm probably preaching to the already converted here, but study and attend services, ceremonies of other traditions. Be respectful and open. I know you guys all know that. Mental health is mental flexibility. In spiritual terms, this means that people who ask a lot of questions may be in much better shape than those who have capitulated to a one-way forever type of theological model. And there's this famous nuns study, a longitudinal study, over 60 years. Anybody read it? It's marvelous. The nuns who asked the embarrassing questions in the novitiate when they were first becoming nuns were the ones who were the most resistant to Alzheimer's. The ones who were pious and devoted and never asked any questions went down. Jerome Bruner, Essays for the Left Hand, he talks about a value of a library of mythologies and creative living from the left hand of inspiration to the right hand of self-actualization. And this is what Robin and I are going to talk about tomorrow. We're going to talk about how you live your myth. How do you walk your talk? Do what Joseph Campbell said. How do you live mythologically? How do you live creatively and spiritually, not under the umbrella of a tradition? And how do you individuate communally? After one of his lectures, Joseph Campbell, of course, was a great believer in science, and he would tell a story about, he would say, you know, between the competition between mythology and science, if the assumption of the Virgin, which is supposed to have taken place in the 17th century, the Virgin was taken up to heaven, if she went slightly under the speed of light, she would still be in our galaxy. You can imagine her kind of flying along
in our solar system.
Through deep interstellar space right now. He that was his idea of humor. And an old lady came up to him and said, Mr. Campbell, are you an atheist? And he said, I hardly think, madam, he's always a gentleman, I hardly think it would be appropriate to call anyone who believes in as many gods as I do an atheist. And that's all, folks. Thank you very much. You know, the right hemisphere, we think of it as being creative, but it is more naturally pessimistic than the left hemisphere. The Dalai Lama and his Tibetan Buddhists that had those 240 electrodes put on their brains, the frontal part of the left hemisphere is the most optimistic part of the brain. It may be Pollyanna foolish optimistic, but it is optimistic.
You mentioned you had a near-death experience. I just wanted to hear more about that.
Okay. I've had actually three. Two of them were, I should say that one of them was so close, it was on the north face of the Grand Teton. I mentioned that I was kind of desire to prove my mother wrong and show how immortal I was, and I climbed a lot of mountains, including north face of the Grand Teton was dangerous because it was very steep and it was plastered together with blocks that were held in place only by black ice, and when the sun would shine on it, these big rocks would fall down, stuff like that. So a friend and I just narrowly escaped death, and it just left us shaken quite profoundly. The second one, I actually took a 100-foot leader fall in the mountains, and in those days we didn't wear helmets, and I fell 70 feet before I hit the hit a ledge, and my arm still has the scar on it, and I still have the scar across my head, but I protected my head with my arm. I was that quick, and I was covered with blood and taken to a hospital, and everybody that saw me was sort of like being in a horror comic when you've been in the swamp too long and you come out and everybody goes, ah, like this when they see you. I was covered with blood. And that one kind of changed my life a little bit. I was extremely explosive and forgetful and hard on my wife. By the way, TBI, one of the obvious symptoms is difficulty in controlling anger and emotions. It's really quite bad. The last one was the most lucid, and I was running a mountain marathon, and I had been training at temperatures like 50 degrees and under, and all of a sudden on the course, it was a day at least 10 to 15 degrees hotter than today with the bright sun out, and the guys who planned the marathon run did not put enough water out on the course, and I was frantic, and there were long spaces because it was a mountain marathon. It was not on a track. There weren't people to hand you water and stuff like that, and I dehydrated, and I was begging for water. I at one point I passed Lake Minnewaska, and I said, I'm going to drink the lake, and somebody said, oh, I wouldn't do that. It's not safe, and I went, well, geez. So there I was within 100 yards of the finish line. And I raised my arms to wave to all my friends, and that was a big mistake because the lactic acid was in the arms. And over I went. Now, while I lay there, my friends saw the event happen from the finish line and came running forward to pour their cold beers all over me, but I was just out of my body. And as I shot out of my body, I was in a kind of a spirit form. It's sort of like I've heard many, many stories like this from other people who have almost died. And I was in the air up above the rock climbing area where the marathon had been taking place. And I could see the climbers hanging on the cliffs. But then when I looked at them, I could see right into their souls. I could see everything that they were thinking, feeling, whether they were nice people or not nice people. When I looked down into the valley, maybe 800 feet below, I could look at a house, and I could see right into the house. I could see what was going on in the house. I could see the people in the house. I could look into their souls and into their brains. And it was really quite a mystical kind of thing. And I saw sort of the truth of everything. I saw that God is not a fiction, because God is everywhere and all around us. At one point, I had been a trainee of Stanislav Grof in LSD therapy at Maryland Psychiatric Research Center. It was one of the most interesting, exciting chapters of my life. And I remember saying to myself in this out-of-body state, I've got to tell Stan. I've got to tell Stan. You don't need to take LSD to see this. It was more profound than any of my LSD experiences. It was really, I was seeing everything. I saw my own life from beginning to end, as it were. At the same time my body was on the ground, a friend of mine who was versed in Tibetan Buddhism, after she finished pouring her beer on me, clamped her hand over the top of my head. Anybody know why? That's the exit. Yeah. And she might have been responsible for keeping me there. We became very, very good friends after that. We were good friends before, but we were very good friends.
She was very solid. I was right beside her.
She was very solid.
She was sometimes chanting, and she was talking to Steve and saying, come on back, we're here, you know.
Then, so it was either that pulling me back or the fact that I
wet.
Had a family with one, I don't think the second child was along at that point. Hetchy, was Winnie alive?
I don't think so.
I don't think she was. And But I have a really loving wife and a beautiful situation and lots of people who love me, and I was being told by an invisible presence that I probably had some more living to do, but I didn't want to go back into the body. I really resisted going back into the body because it was so much fun out there. I mean, it was just absolute freedom, and love, and God was all around, and it